Hello, everybody, and welcome to the AE Dynamite Review Show. The AE Dynamite. Let's try that again. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the AEW Dynamite Review Show here on the unofficial WWE podcast. My name is Mimi Burris, and today is Thursday, March 18th, 2021. And I'm excited to talk about this week's show with you guys, so let's just jump right in.
It's about the 14 years it took me to go from undesirable to un-goddamn deniable! Oh, oh my God!
Good God Almighty, the rope just came off!
Let me hear it, huh?
Paradigm shift!
Your AEW World Champion, Kenny!
My God, Omega!
Because I'm better than you, and you know it.
All right, everybody, it is a little after 8 here on the East Coast, and I've been up for over 13 hours, and I'm not one to like to be up for more than half the day, so I'm a little tired, but I couldn't be more happy than to sit down. Couldn't be happier than to sit down in front of a mic and be able to talk about wrestling with you guys. So this is a perfect ending to a long day for me. I hope you have all had a wonderful week and a wonderful day yourselves. And I hope you all had a great quarantine St. Paddy's Day yesterday with the St. Patrick's Day Slam version of Dynamite. My pop for the show was Penta in the Hornswoggle hat. Just want to get that out of the way real quick. If you didn't see that, it's definitely worth looking up. But let's just jump right into the show and stick to the usual format here and just go down the card so we don't miss a thing. Before we go match by match or segment by segment, I do want to say that overall, I really was not impressed with AEW this week. Not a great show in comparison to its usual shows. I hold AEW to a higher standard because they've proven that they should be held to a higher standard. But still some good stuff to talk about, and we're gonna go through it all. All right, guys. So yeah, like I said, a pretty good show, full of kind of some highs and lows, no pun intended. But we do have an email I want to read a little bit later too, but we can get into that after we get through some segments. Break this whole thing up a little bit. And so yeah, we started off this week with a beautiful shot of the stable we now know as the Pinnacle, but for those, you know, who may not have watched the show or haven't seen the show yet, I don't know why you're listening to a review podcast, but if you hadn't, this MJF stable with Tully Blanchard and FTR and Shawn Spears coming out of a fancy private plane, getting into a fancy SUV, wearing fancy suits, MJF's pinky ring, all the glitz and glam for the for a perfect hook, I guess, to get into or to get excited about hearing what MJF was going to have to say for later on in the show, which, like I said, we will get to. And then we had our first match of the night, which was Cody Rhodes versus Penta. And I was really excited for this match. I'm not going to lie to you guys. I was looking forward to this. I think Cody, it's hard to not look forward to a Cody match most of the time. And I was really hoping that this was going to be a great showing for Penta, who has, you know, a lot of, I guess I can use the word credibility in the luchador scene, and really brings a whole new dimension to luchador wrestling, in my opinion. But I was severely underwhelmed with all that being said. But let's get into it, and I'll explain why in a minute. But I like the idea of what they were trying to do, but I think the problem was in the execution. So Penta cuts a promo during his entrance, or has, you know, the little split screen thing, and he says that he's going to break Cody's arm, so he has to take a early paternity leave. It showed highlights from the Face of the Revolution ladder match to give a good context as to where this animosity for the feud between Penta and Cody was coming from. But I didn't like right from the jump how this match starts off. Right, first of all, Cody comes out like, If I don't have any kids, right? But let me use my dog, which is not even close to the same thing necessarily. But if anybody was talking some stuff about my dog, I'd be furious and want to I don't know. You get my point. I would be angry and fired up. And Penta was talking about Cody's unborn daughter last week, and there was all this fire and rage. And then he just kind of comes out skipping along down the ramp to the ring. And Penta is the first one to throw the first shot with hitting a senton, you know, onto the ramp. Just seemed like the roles were reversed there. I think they should have saw some more fire from Cody. I don't need all the fancy fireworks and stuff when you're, I don't know, this guy was talking about your kid, right? Your unborn kid. So that already set the tone for just not the story not being told well, I guess is my point. And so the story of the match is similar to what's been the story of most of Cody's matches as of late, is, you know, going after the shoulder. And I was okay with the kind of on and off selling at first from Cody, because it's kind of been a theme for him, I feel like. Like, especially in the ladder match, you saw just, like, the non-selling of his shoulder at certain points wasn't like, oh, I'm not just not selling it to not sell it. It was more so, what am I trying to say here? It was more so like, I have enough grit and tenacity to push through the pain. And that's what I thought, at least in the beginning, but we will get down more into the match on where just the non-selling became an issue. There was some great chops from Penta to Cody in the corner, a great backstabber by Penta to Cody. Then on the outside of the ring, Penta sets up the barricade, not the barricade, but you know, that the steel guardrail, on the outside leaning up against another steel guardrail. That was awesome hurricanrana from Cody to Penta, but all of this kind of stuff was just like spot to spot. There wasn't really a great, like, smooth story being told throughout the match, which you expect from these two guys. It was just, I think the best word for it was like underwhelming. Cody goes for the suicide dive. I know they say tope suicida or something like that, but I just call it a suicide dive because I like to be simple on this podcast. And so, yeah, it goes for the suicide dive, and it was just kind of slow, and the way Penta hit the guardrail, like, minimal impact. I don't know if I'm just spoiled by watching Rey Fénix do suicide dives now, but, I mean, even, like, a Seth Rollins or Daniel Bryan or someone could have done a better suicide dive. Though I have to say, there was a great Canadian Destroyer by Cody in the center of the ring for the near fall. And then there was, what's it called? I don't know, remember if it was actually before or after that, but Penta kicks out of a crossroads. There was like a crossroads in the middle of this match, just randomly. This match did not warrant kicking out of a finisher, if that makes any sense. And I don't know if anybody else felt this way about this match, but I was just underwhelmed. Kind of a little all over the place, just like this wonderful podcast has already been, as we're about 10 minutes into it. I didn't love the cadence of the match. I didn't love the story being told. I thought it wasn't being executed very well. I thought these two guys, with the amount of talent in the ring, should have just been doing a better job. Long story go away, the match comes towards an end where Cody kind of just no-sells this move that, you know, from my research or from what I've heard, I've never watched a lot of other promotions outside of the major ones, at least, but supposedly this move that Penta does is supposed to break people's arms, and this is kind of the first showing it's had on AEW, and Cody no-sold it, so there goes that, you know. Any kind of threatening menacingness from Penta went away in this match, and so Cody no-sells that and then rolls up Penta for the 3 count, and boring finish to a boring match, in my opinion, and terrible job with that no-sell. And then so after the match, right, you get Penta attacking Cody, but when I say attacking, I mean like throwing super weak little lazy punches at his shoulder. It was poorly done. I think if I were to have booked this, right, which let me preface it with this. I think AEW does a wonderful booking job 90% of the time, but I thought this just was a miss. And if I were to have booked this, I probably would have had either Penta go over with a submission, or I would have had it be a disqualification finish where Penta just didn't take off a submission while Cody was in the ropes, and then you had the finish that we're going to get to. Or even if Penta lost, then I would have had Penta put Cody in a submission or something afterwards where it actually looks like he's doing something to the shoulder rather than like barely punching him there. It just looked weak and not, this whole thing was just executed poorly. But so the Rhodes family comes out, the Nightmare family comes out and makes the save. I say that with quotation marks, I guess, because really, like I said, it didn't look like Cody was in a lot of danger, which is sad. And then everybody comes out minus QT Marshall. And then QT Marshall comes out a little late and he's like, what's going on, guys? And they're like, you know, WTF, dude, where were you? It just didn't excite me. We get the QT Marshall heel turn. Like, this didn't need to be a vehicle for that. Too much, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen for this one segment. I think this could have been a great feud starter, even if it was down the line between Cody and Penta, and it did not succeed. This was boring, in my opinion. Just a typical wrestling match that I could have seen anywhere, and, you know, it wasn't all elite, let me put it that way. You're probably going to hear me say that a lot on this podcast, because there was a lot of things on this show that were not all elite. So that were my thoughts on that match. I hope you guys enjoyed it more than I do, but I'm a big Cody fan. I don't know if I've ever said this too. He was my favorite in WWE for a long time, actually, which was weird. He was a weird pick, and people were kind of like, why, when I was a little bit younger. But I just always thought he had so much talent, and he was so much better than what he was given, like you hear in the intro to the show here. But he's a super nice guy, and I actually met him at, like, a local diner in my small town, my small hometown, and he and Brandy were just at the diner, and I didn't get a picture or anything, just went up to them, and it was actually after one of these, one of those house shows where he had done the moonsault off the steel cage. I don't know why I'm telling you guys this, but we're on a quick tangent here of, he had just done the moonsault off the steel cage in the, in a dark match in my hometown, or not my hometown, a couple towns over, and he was at a diner that night, and I just went up and said, you know, you guys were really awesome, I'm a big fan, yada yada. Super nice guy, just what you see on TV, couldn't have been nicer. So I'm a huge, long story go away, I guess, I'm a huge fan of Cody, and I also have high hopes for Penta, this just did not deliver. All right, guys, so the next segment was an interview backstage with Alex Marvez, with the Young Bucks. And he asked them, you know, how are you guys, or where's your mindset going into this eventual tag team title match with Death Triangle? And Matt Jackson plays off the two singles losses, his last week and Nick Jackson's about a year ago to Rey Fénix. And basically says, you know, well, we're a tag team and we're the best tag team in the world. So, you know, you might have beat us in singles competition, but we're a tag team. So then Don Callis interrupts and tells them that he brought a t-shirt for their dad. And the shirt says, don't slap knees or don't slap legs when kicking or something like that. Funny, I guess. I popped a little bit, but I don't know. Wasn't the best AEW humor I've seen. So Callis essentially says that the Young Bucks suck now compared to the way they were in New Japan. And that they should go, and then they go back and forth about Kenny. Again, we've seen this before in Kenny Omega's house, supposedly. Just, you know, you're a bad influence on Kenny. What have you done to him? And Callis says, well, the Young Bucks aren't elite anymore. Just another tag team in their basement or something, while Kenny is the god of wrestling. This was bad. For a multitude of reasons. One, the Young Bucks can't act, in my opinion, or at least well. Don Callis is a great heat builder, I think, but why are you burying your AEW tag team champions, right? Like, just as big of a title, supposedly, in this company, in a company with four total titles, you like to think that they're all prestigious. So I don't know why. This just felt unnecessary. It didn't really hit for me. Like I said, the Young Bucks aren't great in these kind of things. It just didn't feel organic. It felt forced. But and really, the job that this segment was supposed to do, which was continue to drive a wedge between the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega, was pretty much done later on in another match that we're going to talk about. But so I just felt like this was unnecessary and, again, just kind of poorly executed. But I like the story beat behind it, so we will talk about this more later on, I assume. So moving on down the line, we go to the Jade Cargill squash match. I actually don't know if I wrote down the woman's name that... Oh, here, I did. Go me. All right. Jade Cargill squash match against Danny Jordan, who we might never see again because, wow, that German suplex was unbelievable. Jade Cargill, this was exactly what it needed to be. Let's talk about how amazing Jade Cargill looks. That's why they had this match, was so nerds like me could get on a podcast. or talk about it with their friends about, look at this chick whose six packs, she probably does have multiple six packs, but whose six pack is insane, arms, legs, muscles everywhere. The woman is beautiful and looks dangerous, to throw it back to Team Bad, Naomi, Sasha Banks, and Tamina, if anybody knows what I'm talking about. But really, this woman is beautiful, dangerous, lethal. She looks incredible, and that's all this match was for. Amazing German suplex, like, threw her all the way across the ring, and then hits her finisher, which I think it's called the Jaded Effect or something like that. Essentially, it's the Glam Slam, the Beth Phoenix Glam Slam, for those of you who know what I'm talking about. But, and 1, 2, 3, and that was the match, and that's all this seemed to be. I'm glad it didn't go any longer, really. There was, like, a big boot or something else, but really, three big moves, bada bing, bada boom, like, we're out of here. And Jade Cargill looks awesome. So, there are a couple things that could get a little bit tighter here and there, but I'm not even here to talk about that. She can work on that little by little, and there's, like, no house shows or anything right now for these, wrestlers to practice, so, in front of a live crowd, so I'm banging into this, and I think it was great, and exactly what it needed to be, no more, no less. Probably one of my favorite things on the show, which is kind of sad, but speaking of my favorite things on the show, what a transition. We are getting into the Pinnacle promo, aka the MJF's new stable. And this was exactly what you would expect. I mean, you put a microphone in MJF's hand and, you know, you're going to get greatness 9.9 times out of 10. So they all come out to the ring. Tully Blanchard starts off recapping the beatdown last week. Says that they took down the baddest group in AEW, making their group the baddest group in AEW, and says that they are at the pinnacle of this sport because they're at the top of the mountain, nowhere else to go. I might disagree with that. I assume the top of the mountain is the championship, but nevertheless, I get the point. And says that he refers to the Four Horsemen and says that he was with the greatest group in pro wrestling at that time in his career, and says that he wants to finish his career with the greatest group of in pro wrestling, aka the Pinnacle, FTR, Shawn Spears, MJF, and Wardlow. So great little what am I trying to say here? Great putting over of this new group from Tully Blanchard, a guy who definitely, you know, if you are a pro wrestling purist, you are 110% valuing this man's words and opinions. And then we get the mic to MJF, who, happy birthday, happy belated birthday to MJF. Scary, that guy. He's only 3 years older than I am and is probably more successful now than I will ever be in my life. So unbelievable the talent this guy has, and we're going to gush over MJF probably for a hot minute on this show, because I think the guy is, if not the best on the mic in pro wrestling today, one of, and a great heat seeker, and just really good at being the worst and the most annoying guy. So I'm actually going to read to you guys some of the stuff that he said, because I don't think I can give it or do it justice, any MJF promo ever, but if you missed this, I want to make sure that you, you get to hear what this promo was. And if you didn't see it, you should go watch it, because me cutting MJF's promo is not going to be nearly as good as MJF cutting it. And if you did watch it, you get to hear it all over again, because this stuff was great. But he takes the mic and he says, "Well, I guess I'm Judas now, huh, Chris? Pretending to like you was no walk in the park. It wasn't easy being the most charismatic man in pro wrestling and having to take a backseat to you for 6 straight months. Every time you talked, I'd have to fall as far back as your hairline." Right, strike one on the hairline. "It wasn't easy, but I sang and I danced and I pretended to like your comedy BS." Because this is a PG show. "But it worked, didn't it? You thought you were taking me under your wing." Oh, I love this line. "You thought you were taking me under your wing, but in reality, I was down there plucking you feather by feather." Like, such a great line. "And then I convinced everyone that I wanted to take over the inner circle, when in reality that was just an elaborate ruse so you wouldn't see what was coming. Chris, from day one, the goal was to kill the inner circle from the inside. I wanted to build my own faction on top of the remains of the inner circle, and boy, have I ever. We are the pinnacle, and we will take every championship and anything else we want. And right now, Chris, we want your locker room. And obviously, I'm getting that off of AEW's website. And it's an abbreviated version of the promo, but I have to say, you know, he went after the hairline. Yeah, I did that. What it didn't mention, he also goes after, you know, the weight of Chris Jericho again. Props to Chris Jericho real quick for, like, I'm sure he was fine with having MJF bury him with this stuff, because I really think he knows that MJF is, like, the next big thing and wants to continue to enhance and better the talent. Because obviously Chris Jericho's in his 50s and he's not going to be around for so much longer. So credit to Chris Jericho, but also, like, as much as MJF is burying Jericho here, he's also putting him over in a way and putting over the Inner Circle really as, like, the baddest group in AEW, not just because they said it outright, but also to take the group down, he had to go in from the inside, you know, like, that says something about how strong a group can be. And so, yeah, I mean, a great promo by MJF. This is one of my favorite segments of the show, and I wouldn't be able to do it justice by just, nothing I say, I guess, is going to be able to do an MJF promo justice ever on this show. But like I said, if you guys didn't watch it, go watch this. This is one of the high spots in this week's Dynamite. And later on, obviously, we get MJF putting the Pinnacle logo over the Inner Circle's and taking the dressing room. And I'm excited to see, hopefully the Inner Circle is back next week and we get a response, because super excited for this feud, the amount of matchups they can do with this. You get Hager and Wardlow again, you get Sammy Guevara and MJF, Sean Spears, Sammy Guevara, FTR versus Santana and Ortiz, you get another Jericho-MJF match, totally different perspective on that. All this kind of stuff that you can do with these awesome new stables that are going to have probably a great feud until the next pay-per-view, I think, which is Full Gear, but don't quote me on that. No, All Out? Exactly, I can't even remember. Anyways, whatever the next pay-per-view is, I'm excited for this, and I think this is going to be an amazing multi-man match, whatever they end up doing, and great feud. Just nothing more I can say about this than A+ all around, you know. I think the only thing, maybe if I were to put on spin on any of this, I would say I'd love to see a little something new from MJF's promo style, just because this is like a new development in his career. Just a little something new. It was kind of all the same stuff, but he was also kind of returning to the MJF of old in a way. So I get that theme, but I'm looking for a little, not like a little bit more, I don't want to use that word, but just a little something new, because, I mean, he did such a good job of putting over the entire group, and even better, putting over himself over the rest of the group, which, again, just a great heel, dictator, stable leader does. But I'm just excited to see, you know, what new kind of dimension he can add, not necessarily to his character, but just his promo skills, if that makes any sense. And so, but yeah, like I said, you know, couldn't have asked for anything better with this. They are... this new stable is going to be something fun to watch, and this new rivalry between the stables is going to be fun to watch too. So, all right, we are moving on down the line, and if I'm correct, I think the next thing was the 10-man tag team match. I did not get to watch AEW until very late last night, so I might have one or two things out of order, but nevertheless, we will make sure to cover everything and in order or not. But next, like I said, yeah, it was a 10-man tag team match, and it was Jurassic Express and Bear Country versus Big Money Matt Hardy's, what did he call it? A dynasty or something? Enterprise. Big Money Matt Hardy's Enterprise, which consisted of Matt Hardy, obviously, Private Party, and The Butcher and the Blade. Overall, I'm not going to spend too much time on the recapping of this match, but just some beatdown on Jungle Boy, some beatdown on Marco Stunt, excuse me, and some, you know, hot tag to Luchasaurus, I think, at one point. Long story, go away. Private Party hit the gin and juice on Marco Stunt, and then Matt Hardy does his typical heel Matt Hardy stuff and begs for the tag so he can come in and hit the Twist of Fate on an already essentially unconscious Marco Stunt and get the three count. So, you know, what I didn't cover quickly in the recap, in that, I'm not even going to call that in a recap, in a quick summary of that match was that, you know, the problem, or the way that they got the advantage, the heels got the advantage in that match, was there was a miscommunication between Bear Country and Jurassic Express, And that is pretty much the story of this match. I don't know. I was bored by this, and I was disappointed that I was bored by this, because like I said, I think AEW handles these multi-man matches very well usually, but I just thought this wasn't handled very well. It was sloppy and not in a good way, and just poor execution, I thought. But to lean on some positives, I will say that the Marco stunt beatdown, essentially, throughout this match is very akin to, I don't know if anybody else gets these vibes, but my first thought is Hornswoggle. Because you remember back in the day, right, and we're talking like Finley Hornswoggle days, like, you know, post Vince McMahon, this is my illegitimate son days. God, wrestling is weird sometimes. But anyways, and when anybody would put their hands on Hornswoggle, like, it was immediate heel heat. Like, you just hated them because it was so annoying because he was such a little miniature guy. You just never really, even how annoying Hornswoggle could get, especially I remember as being a little kid, you never wanted Hornswoggle to get hurt. And so definitely, you know, heat seeking from the Hardy Enterprise when they were all hitting moves on Marco Stunt. I think obviously Marco Stunt is much more talented than Hornswoggle, but at least in the ring, but still kind of the same vibe. And I don't know if anybody else felt that way. So there's one positive there. Matt Hardy wanted to come in after, you know, all the work was done. Another good heat-seeking tactic. And this is another story being developed out of the Battle Royale, or Tag Team Battle Royale at Revolution, which is, you know, Bear Country versus Jurassic Express. I thought the execution was just poor, and, like, the typical, well, can they get along story? Like, it was just, no, oh, they just can't get along, right? Like, it's just boring. How many times have we seen this? And like I said, if this was a WWE match, I probably would have been like, this was great. Or not great, but just serviceable. But I expect better from AEW, and that's all this was serviceable. So moving on down, I'm done talking about that. Let's talk about something good, which was the Moxley and Eddie Kingston promo in the back. You had, again, obviously, Moxley and Eddie Kingston, and I was watching AEW, a little bit of a part of it with my fiance last night, and she was like, he looks like he's got, like, ADD or is, like, on some cocaine or something, and I was laughing. It's like, that's kind of Moxley's character in a weird way. And I don't know if you guys ever heard the Renee Paquette, his first interview on that show. It was so funny. He talked about doing cocaine in libraries, and that's also all I could think of. But, all right, staying on track here. So yeah, great promo backstage. It was kind of fun, cute, and jokey in the beginning. I think they called Gallows some Toy Story character, but talking about how he has, like, googly eyes and whatever. They call the Good Brothers the Cheap Shot Artists, and they live up to the name later on. We'll get into that. But they set up the match basically by saying, you know, Eddie Kingston, again, this is another thing, like, I could try to recap these promos by MJF and Moxley and Eddie and whoever, but I will not give enough justice to any of this stuff. But they essentially, you know, Eddie Kingston gets serious and says, like, you guys, he quotes 50 Cent, I think, and something else. Basically, you know, we got to take care of the problem, and you guys are the problem, and that's what we're going to do tonight. And so, yeah, like I said, I'm not going to do this enough justice, but I will say that it was a great promo and leading into the match. But before we got the match, we had a backstage interview with Christian Cage. And this was serviceable, but boring. And I really feel bad for Christian. I think that he's great. I do like Christian. I think he was always kind of underutilized. And I have to say, I do like that he made it clear that he wasn't, like, worthy of a title shot yet. Really, it was Kenny Omega who interrupted him and took his time, so that's the only reason he was out there. And he was going to have to do a lot of work before he got up to that level to be able to challenge Kenny Omega. I like that. I think we talked about that last week. I was kind of hoping for that. But I did not, I don't know, it just was boring. Like I said, serviceable, and I really think Christian is a victim of the whole overhyping thing back to Revolution. And so, yeah, I don't really think this is Christian's fault. I think, like I said, this was a serviceable interview. Not much more to say to that. I want to see him get in the ring. If he's going to keep talking about outworking everybody or whatever, then get in the ring and show us, because I don't want to hear anything more from Christian Cage. I just want to see him wrestle and see that he can still go after 7 years of being, you know, on the bench. So after the interview, we got into the Moxley and Eddie Kingston match, and the match started off with a ambush from the Good Brothers to Eddie Kingston as he entered down the ramp. And Jon Moxley is all taped up from, obviously, the barbed wire death match that is, I think a lot of people are forgetting how brutal that match actually was because of the pfft we got at the end of it. I'm like, what's it called? I'm like trademarking that now as the pfft. But comes to help Eddie Kingston and brawls with the Good Brothers. But essentially, you know, Anderson and Gallows get the upper hand on both Kingston and Moxley. This match essentially becomes a squash match for most of it because, I mean, obviously these two guys are beat up, or especially Moxley is beat up, and they got the upper hand. So it's kind of just really a dominant match, boring dominant match from the Good Brothers. Towards the end, the Good Brothers attempt the magic killer on Jon Moxley, but Kingston comes up with a chop block to Anderson. Kingston sends Gallo over the top rope into the floor with a running clothesline, and Gallo pulls Kingston out of the ankles and whips him into the guardrail. Moxley rolls up Carl Anderson and pins him for the 1-2-3, and that is the quick recap of the ending, because again, it just wasn't like PG. I don't know if I can say ass on this podcast. You know what? I think I can, so we're going to go for it. I just wasn't asked about this match. But yeah, inside cradle to get the win, another roll up for the night, which is again not very AEW like, but I get it in this instance. Obviously, Jon Moxley is very beat up. The real story though comes after the match. The Good Brothers double team Moxley. Kenny Omega's music hits, and he comes like skipping and dipping out to the ring with a steel chair. Don Callis is with him, and Kenny Omega looks like he's about to start to beat down Moxley, but then Eddie Kingston comes in and breaks him up, he pushes Kenny Omega off the chair, but then the Good Brothers obviously have the numbers game and just the advantage overall, and they stomp on Kingston afterwards and get him over to the corner, put the steel chair on his ankle, and then obviously do that little ankle-breaking spot. And then Anderson and Omega place Moxley's head between the chair, and Gallows goes up to the top turnbuckle to go for the, I don't know, to kill him, essentially. And then you get the Young Bucks coming out, who come out to make the save. And this is where, like, the plot thickens a little bit, and I thought this was, like, this was all this story needed for the night. It didn't need that weird backstage promo, but, you know, the Bucks basically save Moxley's life and say, like, you know, just it was bound to happen because you've got a heel group and a baby face and they're supposedly friends, right? They're gonna have weird like tension moments like this, and this is what you can build off. And I thought, like, this was great storytelling. They don't need to say anything, and obviously they're having words back and forth. Kenny Omega goes to try to do it again, and the Young Bucks come in again and make the save. And then Omega puts his hand up, to do the too sweet thing, and the Bucks resist, and then essentially leave the ring, and Moxley gets to his feet and just starts swinging the chair left and right. It was funny, and the Good Brothers and Kenny Omega retreat, and that is the end of that segment. And like I said, this was all the story needed to, continue to progress. I like that, it was a kind of like a good versus evil, like this is how we got to the top versus how you're getting to the top now. Kind of similar to, I don't know, for some reason I got this weird, it made me think about that time when Edge came back to WWE to say, like, Christian, congratulations on your world title win, but you won it by, like, spitting in the face of Randy Orton and having him DQ you or get DQ'd. Just like a heel baby face when they're friends in or outside of wrestling or whatever in kayfabe. You get this special dynamic that isn't done well all the time, but this is being done well, I think, for the most part. And so I like this dynamic, and on to something I didn't like so much. We had a Tony Schiavone interview with the TNT champion Darby Allin and Sting for, I think, maybe the 14th week in a row, just interviewing Sting every week. It's like, hey, guys, AEW, and by the way, Sting is here. Like, so sick of this, man. So sick of these quote-unquote Sting interviews. And this week, Sting didn't say a word the entire time. Whatever. Darby comes out and says that, you know, I've only defended this title 3 times. So funny. The crowd was like, woohoo, yay. And no, Darby's like, no, that's bad. I want to defend this every week, essentially. And he pays a little tribute to Brody Lee and says that he wants to defend, he wants to give an open challenge to anybody in the Dark Order for the TNT title next week. And then Lance Archer and Jake the Snake Roberts come out and interrupt them. And I thought, oh my God, am I having deja vu? Or are they just replaying something from last week? Because this was the same thing as last week, essentially. Long story go away, Lance Archer cuts a promo on Sting and says, exactly what I was thinking. Like, right, how many times are you going to interview Sting? It should be my time. And Darby, you're the TNT champion. The internet might think you're terrific, but as far as I'm concerned, you're the biggest indie-rific joke this business has ever seen. And I like this. I have to say, I did like this line. And you like coffins so much, well, I'm about to put your ass in one. Jake Roberts takes the mic, and this was tough, man. Says, Sting, you know me, and you're going to get what's coming to you. Tony Khan better realize you don't play with fire. This is the biggest, baddest son of a bitch here. I don't know if I can say that on this podcast, but I just did. I'm quoting. It's a quote. And he will twist it up, and he will shove it up your rear end, so be careful, boy. This was bad. This was weird and bad. And then, let's top it all off, right? Taz's group comes out and Brian Cage says, like, no, I want to say something tonight, Taz. Like, you're not speaking for me. Goes up to Darby Allin and Sting and says, basically, Sting, I respect you. You're still the icon. And I gotta say, Ricky Starks was wrong. With or without a bat, you are still the icon. And then, there was a few things in this segment that popped me. I think one of the guys in Taz's group was like, what are you doing, dude? Are you smoking crack or something? Like, whatever. It was funny. And they're all like, what's wrong with you? Whatever. And then Brian Cage pushes his way through the group and leaves through the tunnel. And the reason I said, ugh, another thing is because, like, why are we going to break up, you know, or start creating some tension in Taz's group? I love Taz's group. I think it's such a great group of guys, a great dynamic. I understand there's another heel stable now going on, but you also have another babyface stable because the Inner Circle just turned babyface. So keep this stable going. I get it that in kayfabe it makes sense. You guys took a big loss. There should be repercussions. Again, all kayfabe, but hopefully this is just a little blurb in the road and all this group can stay together. And hopefully next week we don't have another Sting interview for no point. I get it. Sting's on AEW. We get it. The icon is on AEW. It snows in Jacksonville, Florida. I don't care. I'm so sick of this stuff, this Sting stuff. The street fight was great, but it wasn't good enough for me to just want to see Sting's face every week on AEW and bask in the glory of Sting. That just doesn't do it for me as a fan. If there are some people out there who love this nostalgia act a lot, cool. And in regards to Darby Allin, you know, I've praised Darby Allin on the show before, and I think he can do a lot of great stuff. I think he is way more than indie-rific, obviously. You know, despite, if you are able to put some of the stuff that has been, you know, alleged against him to the side and enjoy what he does in the ring, power to you. I struggle with it sometimes, but I'm just so sick of seeing these two guys come out and do little to nothing. Like, let's have Darby Allin wrestle and Sting stop just being like, let Sting do great things if Sting can do great things instead of just have an interview every week. Like, it's just such a obvious, like, ratings grabber, and I think it's boring, and like I said, I think if this works for you guys and you guys like the nostalgia act, power to you. It does nothing for the 22-year-old fan, right, who Sting doesn't mean anything to me. I know of Sting. I've seen Sting matches. I get it, right? But it doesn't do anything for me because I'm here to watch AEW, not WCW or TNA or whatever, right? So if you want to have Sting have his own legacy in AEW, then have him have his own legacy in AEW. But an interview every week doesn't really lead to that. All right, speaking of legacies in AEW, we had the Rey Fénix match with Pac versus Angelico. And to make a long story go away with this match, a long back and forth between these two guys, and then Rey Fénix ends up getting the pin after hitting Angelico with a Death Valley driver, I think, and gets the 1-2-3. And I don't know, I would have rather seen Nick Jackson versus Rey Fénix, or Matt Jackson versus Rey Fénix again, honestly. Or Pac versus Matt Jackson, or Nick Jackson, one of the Young Bucks. I don't care. I would have loved to see more little kind of like one-on-one stuff. This match didn't do a lot for me. I don't know. It's kind of sad because Rey Fénix had such a high expectations that, this just didn't live up to the other matches that he's had. But you put this match on any other show and you don't have a lot of knowledge about Rey Fénix, and you'd be amazed by Rey Fénix because he's Rey friggin' Fénix. So, all right, real quick, guys. Now I want to move on to the main event because that is the biggest talking point coming out of this week's Dynamite. Like I said, overall, the show just kind of didn't do it for me in most spots. There were some good points, but, you know, the main event tied the whole thing together, and I think if it was on a better show, it probably would have even had a better, reception. So we're going to go through this match a little bit and hit some of the high spots so I can make sure I, again, give as much credit as I possibly can to these two women. Obviously, the first ever main event for the women in AEW, and I couldn't think of any other better women to put in than Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa. You guys have heard me on this podcast, if this is not your first time listening, say that I adore Britt Baker. I mean, I hate her because she's a heel and she does a great job of it, but I think I adore her as a worker. I think she's incredible. I think she is the face of this women's division. I think she has it all going for her. And so, like I said, I couldn't think of two better women. And Thunder Rosa, you know, deserves the credit too. Obviously, a great, just pure baby face. So let's get into the details of this match. They start the match with a stare down, and then Rebel blindsides Thunder Rosa, swinging in a crutch at her. And then, obviously, Thunder Rosa goes after Rebel, but Britt Baker gets her and follows it up with a air raid crash on the stage, but Thunder Rosa kicks out. Britt Baker hits Thunder Rosa with a chair shot and then does her typical, wonderful Britt Baker cocky, you know, stuff, turning back into the camera, and that obviously gives Thunder Rosa time to pick up a chair and whack Britt Baker with it. Moving along in the match, though, later on, Thunder Rosa hits a running double knee to Baker in the corner. She sandwiches Baker between the ladder and the turnbuckles, and Thunder Rosa drop kicks the ladder, ramming it into Baker's face. Britt Baker is busted open, and I did miss before, too. I love this spot. Britt Baker, like, stomps Thunder Rosa's head against the steps outside, too, and that's when Thunder Rosa gets cut open. A lot of blood in this match, mostly from Britt Baker. Thunder Rosa bites down on Britt Baker's cut, which was unsanctioned worthy. But Britt Baker retaliates with a thrust kick and hits the flatliner on her, right onto the ladder. That looked brutal. Both these two women are just like drenched in color. Baker climbs up the turnbuckles, but Thunder Rosa follows her and then, hits her with a Death Valley driver down onto the ladder. Thunder Rosa covers Britt Baker, but it's only a two count. Baker DDTs Thunder Rosa onto a steel chair and then stomps Thunder Rosa's head onto the chair. And then somehow, again, just a near fall. And then she gets the black glove out and we think, okay, here we go, lockjaw. Instead, Rebel reaches under the ring and what does she grab but thumbtacks? Like, as if this match couldn't have gotten more brutal. More blood, more whatever. Obviously, Britt Baker pours the thumbtacks in the middle of the ring. Goes to hit Thunder Rosa. I forget what she even tried to do onto the thumbtacks. But Thunder Rosa reverses it. Powerbomb onto the thumbtacks. And like, oh, it looks bad. But like, when she turns over and you see how many are in her back, it's just like, I knew Mick Foley and Terry Funk felt that somewhere. You know, oh, it looked bad. And then they're like rolling around in it later, obviously. Britt Baker later on goes for the lockjaw, and the reversal to it is like Thunder Rosa just goes, all right, let me just like turn on my back, or turn you on your back onto the thumbtacks. Like, that'll end the submission. Long story go away. The end of the match, Thunder Rosa off the apron, hits Britt Baker with the Fire Thunder Driver through the table, and it looked brutal. I mean, like, half of Britt Baker's body was under the ring. Her hair was drenched in blood. This whole match was unbelievably hardcore. And these two women showed up and showed out. Absolutely. I think an incredible first ever women's main event. I mean, showed that these women should be able to do all the matches that the men are able to do. And they did not, they did deliver. They did not disappoint. Really intense feud and a great payoff. I assume the feud's over, considering that the babyface won. That's usually the storytelling beats. But like I said, a great hardcore match. I can't give this enough credit. I'd love to hear what you guys think about this. I love a little color, don't get me wrong, but I don't need, I'm not a big hardcore fan. Like, I like some of the old ECW stuff, but, like, I'm not in it for just senseless violence for senseless violence sake. Call it my lack of testosterone, I don't know, but I think this match in particular wasn't that. It was violence for the sake of the feud, not just for senseless violence sake. And I think these two women had built up a feud big enough that deserved this kind of blow off, and they did a great job. I mean, every move kind of felt like it was done with purpose. And Britt Baker, like, I'm gonna close my eyes tonight and I'm gonna see that image of Britt Baker's face just drenched in blood, smiling into the camera. Oh my God, she is unbelievable, and I cannot wait for her to be the women's champion someday soon, hopefully. But this was awesome. And Thunder Rosa deserves all the credit in the world. But the bumps that these two women took, like, on their heads over and over and over in this match, just, I, on a podcast here, could not do it enough credit. So if you didn't watch this match, I always say, go watch it. Awesome. The only thing I would say about it was, I don't know if anybody else was thinking this, or maybe I missed something, but, like, where was Nyla Rose and Maki Ito? Like, didn't they just form a stable or something 2 weeks ago, or at Revolution or whatever? And last week they had that tag team match. I don't know. I assume actually Maki Ito is back in Japan. I think if I'm correct, but I just didn't get that part. I mean, Rebel was out there. Why wasn't the rest? Like, if I had a stable, I'd want them to help me in a match like this. That's unsanctioned. Excuse me. No DQs, obviously. It just seemed like that kind of just dropped. And they also announced a match for Nyla Rose next week, but versus, I think, Ty Conti, if I'm correct. But I don't know. That seemed like a plot hole to me. But nonetheless, I don't want to end this on a low note. I want to end it on a high note and say that this match was incredible. A great ending to a rather mundane, fairly disappointing. I think, you know, when your parent used to say to you, I'm not mad at you, I'm just disappointed. That's kind of how I felt about a lot of this AEW. I wasn't mad. I was just disappointed, because I expect a lot more from AEW. And I really wasn't. My fiance does not watch a lot of AEW with me. And she offered to watch some of it last night. And this was what I had to show her. I would have been much happier showing her last week's show, is my point, I guess. And this main event put a beautiful wrapping paper job and bow on a not so pretty present. So wonderful, wonderful, wonderful main event from the women, and an overall average AEW. But hopefully next week the story beats continue. Hopefully the execution's a little bit better, and hopefully AEW whips its butt into shape, because the ratings for the last 2 weeks have not been great in comparison. So before we finish up here tonight, though, guys, I do want to make sure I get to, I totally forgot until now, so I'm glad I remembered, but I do want to make sure I get to our email. I got an email from DJ Kuzmo about last week's AEW, so we're going to talk briefly about that. But before we jump into that, I do want to say, if you guys want to email me your thoughts on AEW or on anything with the highs and lows of the week, I do have a couple emails for that that we'll talk about on Saturday. But you can email me at mimi, M-I-M-I dot W-W-E, no, always do that, guys. Every time. Mimi.real. All right. Last time. Mimi.real. WWEpodcast@gmail.com. Shoot me an email and I would love to get your thoughts on the show, obviously, if we have the time for it, and we usually do. So this was DJ Kuzmo's thoughts about last week. I usually record the show about maybe 24 hours within AEW, so if you want your thoughts on the actual show of that week, if you can get me an email within 24 hours, I will probably feature it on the show. But like I said, this is about last week. And DJ says, hey, Mimi, I'm currently listening to your AEW review show. He also heard some weird background noises during some parts of the AEW last night. And it really was just that Ethan Page match. I heard that if he had Fight TV or whatever, people didn't have a problem with it. But otherwise on TNT, everybody did. Oh, it was so bad. I felt so bad for Ethan Page. He says, in the segment with No, excuse me, I'm skipping. All right, he says, anyway, great showing of Rey Fénix versus Matt Jackson to start the show. It's just a matter of time till Death Triangle wins the tag team title belt. Oh, I wish, DJ, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think this feud with the Good Brothers is going to outweigh whatever Pac and Fénix are doing for now. Hopefully, later on down the line, obviously. I would say within the year 2021, that at least one of these guys will hold some kind of gold. I'd really like to see Rey Fénix hold a singles title too, and Pac. I feel like I sleep on Pac a lot in this podcast, but Pac is unbelievable, you know, just as unbelievable. You guys know I'm just a big Rey Fénix fan. He says, in the segment with Moxley and Eddie Kingston, I don't know about you, but doesn't Moxley look wasted? Moxley can be hilarious without trying to be hilarious, if that makes any sense. Yeah, 100% agree. Moxley is hilarious. I think that's like, you guys heard me earlier on the show, right? My girlfriend was like, he always looks like he's on drugs or something. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of just Moxley's gimmick. And it works. He says, sidebar, doesn't it look like Orange Cassidy is kind of bored in the segment with him and Chuck Taylor versus Kip Sabian and Miro? Orange Cassidy needs to get back to either the upper mid card or main event status and Chuck without Trent feels like he's missing his best friend. No pun intended. Hope to see Trent come back soon. I'm 100% in agreement with you. You just reminded me too. I totally missed that whole little Miro segment. Miro and Kip Sabian backstage thing. I guess we'll cover that now, but my guess as to where this program is going is I assume Miro will squash the both of them next week, or they'll lose in some kind of roll-up thing, and it'll be Kip's fault. Miro will ditch Kip Sabian, and I would say we're seeing Miro hold gold within the next year or two as well, or at least he's in the title picture within 2021. I really think they love Miro, and I don't blame him. Miro can be really talented. I think this is just this gimmick's not letting him shine. And the same goes for Orange Cassidy. I think Orange Cassidy is an amazing gimmick and an amazing character that you never thought would be as big as it is, but it is, and it works. And I think you're right. I think Truck. If they ever had a couple name, it would be Truck. But no, Chuck needs Trent and Orange Cassidy and Miro and everybody just needs to, Kip Sabian, whatever, Penelope Ford, they all just need to, like, move on to a separate thing. So, all right. The MJF double heel turn was so good. Brilliant, brilliant. This is why I love MJF's heel heat. In my opinion, MJF was never a good fit for the Inner Circle. Inner Circle got screwed. I'm so excited for MJF's new stable and the potential new storyline angles. Next week, St. Patrick's Day is going to be awesome. Cody versus Penta, Thunder Rosa versus Britt Baker, the Good Brothers versus Moxley and Kingston, and I'm also excited to see Jade Cargill back in action next week. So, yeah, I mean, we talked about it. MJF is incredible, and he was incredible this week, and this new stable is awesome, and I'm with you. That's the word I was looking for, I think. Thank you, DJ. Angles, the amount of angles that they can do, because this is what happens when you set up a company, right, with all these factions. You know who's aligned with who, you know, and how you can set up matches without having to blow them off before the actual pay-per-view match. It's just such a brilliant way to keep everything interesting, but also keep storylines progressing and not feel like you're just filling TV time. these 2 hours rarely feel like they're just like, oh, we need to fill this amount of time. Like, it, I guarantee these guys are fighting for a couple minutes on Dynamite every week. And you can tell, like, because they work hard and they obviously have to earn it with their performances on Dark and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm with you, DJ. I think this MJF thing, I keep calling it the MJF thing, the pinnacle. I don't want to sleep on FTR or Sean Spears or Tully Blanchard. But I think this new stable, new heel stable in the Inner Circle are going to make a great new continuous angle for the next couple months. And for I guarantee for most of 2021, I guarantee we see the storyline go for a long time. So if you would have told me that the Inner Circle were going to be baby faces a year ago, I would have called you crazy. But it doesn't seem like a better fit than it does now. And with your regards to this show was going to be awesome this week, I was really hoping it was too, but it just wasn't for me. Though I have to say, like I said, I do agree with you. Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa this week was incredible. One of the best unsanctioned matches I've ever seen, period. So that is it for this week, guys, though. Like I said, if you want to shoot me your emails about AEW, please do. Otherwise, I have a couple for the highs and lows this week too, and we're going to talk about that on Saturday. And so, thanks for listening. Hope you have a wonderful rest of your week, and I will talk to you guys soon.